I read this week about what is known as the Paris effect. The Paris effect is the term that psychiatrists came up with to describe the disappointment that many first-time visitors experience after hyped-up expectations from the media about Paris don't come to fruition. I read in the Wall Street Journal, it said this, it was a Japanese psychiatrist working in France who first identified the syndrome in the 1980s, which often affects women who arrive expecting an affluent and friendly European capital where slim, beautiful Parisians walk around smelling of Chanel. The article went on to note that many Japanese and now Chinese visitors, quote, expect a place full of romance, beauty, and wealth. Instead, what they find are pavements peppered with cigarette butts and aggravated commuters in packed metro trains. For some, the shock is too much to bear, prompting symptoms that may include irritability, fear, obsession, depressed mood, and a feeling of persecution by the French. In some extreme cases, the only remedy is a one-way ticket out of France. In other words, disappointment sets in when the visitors realize that daily life in the City of Light is not what they expected it to be. The bottom line from the psychiatrist is that Paris does not satisfy. Because when these visitors come to this City of Light, they're looking for a place that will satisfy the deepest inner longings of their heart. They're looking for people, and they're looking for a person who will ultimately satisfy also the deepest longings of their heart. In fact, I would go so far to say is that when you, if you love a city break, if you love going to these great places, is you're looking for that city which is to come. And so the person that they're looking for is Jesus, even if they don't know it. And the place that they're longing for and looking for is heaven, even though they don't know it. As we drop down now into Mark chapter 6, verse 30, we meet many people just like us, many people in the crowds, who were longing for something more. They were longing for someone to satisfy them. They're longing for someone to lift them out of the mundane life that they were living. They were longing for that great banquet that is to come. So let's see another perspective of the servant king. And in this passage, we'll see him as the all-satisfying servant king. We'll see him as the all-satisfying servant king. If you look back as we sort of skip through what happened under Herod's leadership, if you look back in chapter 6 in the verses sort of 20 and onwards, you'll see that Herod is off in his palace. He's carousing with his cronies. He's got parties full of lots of girls. He's beheading prophets, and his henchmen are out on the ground oppressing people. And so what you have is an area led by Herod, but the people are desperate for leadership. The people are desperate for someone who's wholesome and good and righteous, someone that they can follow. And what a contrast then with this banquet that Jesus is going to offer, where he wouldn't be taking from the people. He wouldn't be oppressing the people. But he'll have compassion on the people, and he'll be giving to the people. So let's see this spiritual rest that the all-satisfying servant king offers. Look at this first movement then in verse 30, this spiritual rest. The apostles returned to Jesus. See, we can't help but remember back at the start of chapter 6 where we were a week ago, Jesus had sent them out on their short-term missionary trips. He'd sent them out in two. So Jesus is extending his ministry through the disciples. And so like some of you who are teachers, the students come back with all of their reports about what they've been able to do. They can't wait to tell Jesus about their exploits. But they're tired physically, emotionally, spiritually. And Jesus understands this. And so verse 31, he said to them, come away by yourselves to desolate place. Now, in the original text, it's what we could also translate as the wilderness or to the desert. Come away by yourselves to the wilderness and rest for a while. You see, in every advance in anything in life, there always needs to be a time where you take stock, where you get the reserves back again. So Jesus recognizes this even in their crusade for Christ, that they need time to rest and re-equip. But Mark uses this phrase, a desolate place, to the wilderness. Why do they need to rest? Well, look at verse 31. For many were coming and going, and they had no leisure even to eat. As we would say in Northern Ireland, they didn't even have a moment to bless themselves. They're so busy. The crowds are pressing in upon them. Jesus has extended his ministry through them. And so these disciples have gone out in their twos, and they're spreading all around this Galilee region. And so many are flocking around them. Jesus is a celebrity figure, but now the disciples are a celebrity figure, and they're all flocking, thousands of people, to see these disciples and Jesus. But John, in his parallel account, in John 6, verse 4, says this: the Jewish Passover feast was near. This is an important point, and we'll see that unfold. It's interesting as well, all four Gospels record this account. It's the only miracle that is recorded in all four Gospels. And so the disciples, what do they do with the words of Jesus? Verse 32, and they went away in the boat to this desolate wilderness, desert place by themselves. I imagine the men chatting on the boat. Hasn't this been incredible? Jesus has been so kind to us, not only to teach us and to train us, but now he's really looking after us by sending us away together with him to get some rest and renewal. Isn't this great? We just need a break, don't we, guys? But look at verse 33. But many saw them going, and they recognized them, and they ran there on foot from all the towns and got there ahead of them. Now, I don't think that the boat was going from the western area of the Sea of Galilee to the eastern area. I think Jesus and his disciples are just trying to get somewhere down the lake. But they're able to literally see thousands of people running on foot, trying to keep up with them along the coast, and they actually manage to get to where they're going before the boat gets there. They're coming from all the towns. And when he went ashore, verse 34, he saw a great crowd. Now, I want you to imagine if you were standing in the midst of the crowd. What is it the crowd really want? What is it that you really want from Jesus? Good question to ask of the crowd. Good question to ask of us. Historians tell us that the crowds in and around this area were in favor of the zealot movements. Galilee, and particularly this part of Galilee, which lay within an eyeshot of Gamaliel, was the spearhead of freedom movements against Rome. An unusual number of signs thus suggests that many of them were aflame with messianic fervor. They hoped that Jesus would lead them by force, that he would set up a guerrilla force that would go down to Jerusalem and expel the Romans. And so this crowd are coming to Jesus, not wanting to hear from Jesus, wanting to tell Jesus what he's going to do next. We know this from John's account, because John 6, verse 15, John tells us that the crowd, quote, intended to come and make him king by force. But Jesus doesn't want to be a guerrilla force leader. Jesus wants to show that he is a leader like Moses. The time of the Passover is near. And so what is his heart like for the crowds? Because Mark often wants us to consider who Jesus is. What is he like? But look at verse 34. What does he feel like for the crowd? And he had compassion. He had compassion on them. Do you know this word compassion in the original text is only ever used to describe the heart of Jesus. He looked at this harassed, helpless crowd who wanted to come and take the Romans out by force. It's leaderless, shepherdless, restless, spiritually hungry, spiritually thirsty. Jesus sees this people without direction, without purpose, and without a leader. And maybe that's how you feel this morning. As you think what you might have been feeling that day if you were in the crowd, or as you sit here this morning in church and look at your life and it looks purposeless and it looks directionless and your life looks leaderless, I want you to feel Jesus' compassion, not just for them, but for you. Why did he feel this? Look at verse 34, because they were like sheep without a shepherd. This little phrase is all over the Bible in Numbers 27, verse 17. That they may not be as a sheep that have no shepherd. Ezekiel 34, verse 5. So they were scattered because they had no shepherd. The people were like restless, wandering sheep. And that can describe many of us after perhaps this pandemic is hopefully passing away. You look at your life and you go, it appears directionless, and your heart is restless. And I read this week a couple of commentators speaking about modern life. One writer says you can see this restlessness in people everywhere, in our love for screens with its diversions and distractions, in our demand for endless varieties in what we eat and what we drink and what we wear, in our appetite for mind-altering substances, in our fascination with crisis in almost every area of human life. This writer goes on to say restlessness seems to increase with privilege rather than the reverse. The modern middle class, this writer says, is restless in the midst of their well-being. Restless. Why are we restless? Because from Genesis 3 onwards, when God spoke to Adam and Eve, he said, you can have anything in this garden, but don't touch that fruit from the tree of the knowledge of evil. But because they wanted to be like God, knowing good and evil, they were cast out of the garden. And so as one writer says, an orphan spirit pervades our human heart. Because we're cast out of the garden and we're in this wilderness, desert-like experience, and we're wondering, what is our purpose? Who do we serve? Who are we living for? And we look for identity and purpose and direction and leadership in all the wrong places apart from Jesus. And so Jesus speaks to the crowd in Matthew 11. He says, come to me and you'll find rest, not for your body so that you have a nap, but that you'll have rest for the restlessness in your soul. For my yoke is easy, and my burden is light. Let me say this as plainly as possible. No person, no place, no promotion, no payment, and no political manifesto can satisfy the deep, earnest restlessness in your soul and mind. Nothing will. And yet much of our society is built in getting that next thing, only to find we want something more. Jesus says, come with me into the wilderness. Come with me into the desert place. Find true meaning for your soul. And now he's going to show how they can find, and we can find that meaning and rest for our soul. Secondly, as he provides spiritual food. Look at verse 35. He provides this second major thing, not just spiritual rest, but spiritual food. And when it grew late, his disciples came to him and said, this is a wilderness place, Jesus. This is a desert. This is a desolate place. And the hour is now late. You see, if you're driving home at night, thankfully, there's often a Maxwell garage open. There's even the blessing of some 24-hour McDonald's. It's hard when you've got kids because they never want to pass it without calling in, especially that new one in East Belfast. That's just a killer, but that's for another time. They know what's there. They can see the arches. But they didn't have it here in this first century. This is a wilderness place. The hour is now late, Jesus. They've got to get home. Send them away to go into the surrounding countryside and villages and by themselves. You see, some of the disciples would have had literally the people they had ministered to come and follow them. They've gone out in their twos. And so people from all the surrounding towns who they have been ministering to are following them. And they know these people have got to get back. But Jesus gave them the answer they didn't want. Verse 37, but he answered, you give them. You emotionally drained disciples, you worn out disciples, you give them something to eat. But sarcastically, they replied to Jesus, shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give it to them to eat? Jesus, we don't have a year's salary sitting here in our laps able to pay for food for them. Jesus, what we have is insufficient. Jesus, humanly speaking, this is an utter impossibility. What the disciples reveal is what you and I often feel in the midst of challenging situations. Humanly in our lives, when we have a circumstance that appears there's no way out, there's no solution, there's no human plan that will get us out of this one. And so we, like the disciples so often, forget who is that's walking beside us and with us as Christians. The cry of the disciples here is similar to the heart cry of Moses in the wilderness when he was trying to feed God's grumbling people. He said in Numbers 11, verse 13 to God, where am I to get meat to give to all these people? For they weep before me and say, give us meat to eat, Moses, that we may eat. Moses went on, Numbers 11, verse 21, but Moses said, the people among whom I am, number 600,000 on foot, probably up to 1 million when you include the children, I will give them meat that they may eat for a whole month. Shall flocks and herds be slaughtered for them and be enough for them? Or shall all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them and be enough for them? And the Lord spoke to Moses like he'll also now speak to his disciples. Is the Lord's hand shortened? That you shall see whether my word will come true for you or not. This story is a reenactment of what happened in the wilderness with Moses. The people were grumbling. The people needed food. Moses was the great mediator and leader. So here there are thousands of people with a new Moses, with a new Joshua, who need food, who need provisions, who need direction, who need purpose. And so what will Jesus do? You see, the disciples complain about what they lack. Jesus wants them to focus on what they possess. The problem will not be resolved by something beyond them, but by something among them. Jesus sees possibilities. The disciples see impossibilities. Jesus says, what do you have? It's a good question for us to then ask if we were in the crowd or as we sit here today. And we look at our life perhaps as restless and directionless. Jesus says, what do you have? What can you give me? Even though it's small and insignificant. To you. What can Jesus do with it when he puts it in his hands? It's interesting, somebody's brought their wee brown bag with them. The disciples have spotted it. Some wee fella's got his 5 Ormo Baps and some nice Tesco ham. There are other brands available. And when they find out, they go into the crowd. Verse 38. And they say, oh, Jesus, what we've got? We've got 5 pieces of bread and we've got 2 fish. It's ludicrously inadequate, Jesus. We're so limited here, Jesus. Let's just move on. Let's just send them home. We're all tired. Let's end the day, Jesus. But you see, Jesus didn't need the 5 pieces of bread and the 2 fish. He didn't even need the disciples. This is the same God-man who created this world, what theologians call ex nihilo, out of nothing. But the mystery of God is he wants to use weak, insignificant people like us to be part of building his kingdom. He's going to take these five ridiculous pieces of bread. He's going to take these two pieces of fish and these weary and worn out disciples. And so verse 39, he commanded them all to sit in groups on the green grass. And so they sat in groups by hundreds and by fifties. Here's another allusion to what Moses did in the wilderness in Exodus 18:21. It's also striking because what they find in a place called Qumran in Israel is a place where lots of scrolls and theological writings were found. And listen to what they find in the Qumran caves. They find documents in the Qumran caves that use these same subdivisions to describe what God's people will do in the last days around our God. And so there's something here that Jesus is doing. He's looking back to what Moses, the mediator and the leader of God's people, did with his grumbling people in the wilderness when he provided literally food from heaven to keep them going in the midst of a desolate place. Jesus is saying, I am the new Moses. I am bringing about a new salvation, not from Pharaoh, a wicked leader, but from sin itself. But this meal in this wilderness-like place is also looking forward to what Jesus is going to conduct for all eternity in that great banquet in heaven. Mark portrays, as one writer says, Jesus as the end-time Savior. The second Moses who transforms a leaderless flock into the people of God. The multiplication of the loaves recalls the gifts of manna in the Exodus. Jesus leading the people as a shepherd recalls Moses leading a fledgling nation. Like Moses, Jesus divides the people into groups. There's probably 20,000 people here. Now, some of you who like sport, you know that I'm partial to it. Windsor Park just holds shy of 20,000 people. So does Ravenhill, the Kingspan. Imagine a stadium full of 18 or 20,000 people and Jesus with the disciples standing in the midst of them. And so Jesus, verse 41, and taking the five loaves and the two fish, he looked up to heaven and said a blessing and broke the loaves and gave them to the disciples to set before the people. And he divided two fish among them all. What a contrast to the Herodian feast in the little pericope before this one. Herod, the leader of the people at this time, is feeding himself. He's taking from the people. He's abusing the people. Here's Jesus literally giving to the people. And consider what he would ultimately give to them in the greatest feast of all. At the communion table, he'll give of himself. The God who gave manna in the wilderness, who made a startling provision for his servants, Elijah and Elisha, now will give to his new people daily bread. And who does he use? He uses the disciples. Look at the end of verse 41. And he gave this new bread to the disciples to set before them. As we said earlier, Jesus didn't need the boys' bread. Jesus didn't need the boys' fish. Jesus didn't need the disciples. Do you know what he uses, though? Us. I love what R. Kent Hughes said this. God must delight in using ordinary people with ordinary gifts because he made so many of us. God must delight in using ordinary people with ordinary gifts because he made so many of us. And the Apostle Paul, I think, reflects on this when he says in 2 Corinthians 5, verse 20, therefore we are ambassadors for Christ, God making his appeal through us. He did it with the disciples here, saying, I am the new Moses. This is a new Exodus. He's pointing forward to this great salvation rest that he's going to give for people who will flee from their restlessness and come to the one who can give them rest. Elizabeth Elliot, who lost her husband, Jim, tragically in the mission field, when he was killed for his faith. She said this: if the only thing you have to offer Jesus is a broken heart, you offer a broken heart, realizing that nothing I have and nothing I am will be refused part of Christ if I simply give it to him, as she said, as the little boy gave Jesus his 5 loaves and 2 fish. Can I ask you this morning, what little can you give him? And I'm not talking about money. I'm talking about your life. Many of you by default say, Jesus could never use me. And that statement in itself is what qualifies you. God makes his power perfect in our weaknesses. What can we offer him? Because what does Jesus show here? What are the results? Well, they all ate. All, say 10, 15, 20,000 of the men, women, and children, all ate, verse 42, and were satisfied. But what is Jesus saying here? Well, John helps us in his account. He gives us insight after the event. Jesus takes the disciples aside in John 6, verse 35. Then Jesus declared, I am. Here's the meaning of the story. I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will never go hungry. And he who believes in me will never be thirsty. You see, many in the crowds didn't get the meaning. That Jesus was pointing forward to what he was going to do on the cross. That he was going to come and satisfy our deep inner longings for a relationship with him. And this was a fulfillment of what God's prophet Isaiah had said in Isaiah 55, verse 1. It's a wonderful invitation to us all today. Come. Come, all of you who are thirsty. Come to the waters. And if you don't have any money, come. Come buy. Come and eat. Come buy wine and milk without your money and without cost. Why spend your money in this 21st century on what is not bread? And in this 21st century, why labor on what doesn't satisfy your deep inner longings? The prophet says, listen. Listen to me. And eat what is good, and your soul will delight in the richest of fare. Only Jesus can satisfy the deep inner longings in your soul. You see, no wine at the wedding was no problem for Jesus. No food in the wilderness was no problem for Jesus. No apparent life in the tomb was no problem for Jesus. And what do the disciples do next? Verse 43. They took up 12 basketfuls of broken pieces and of the fish, and those who ate the loaves were 5,000 men. I wonder what the people in the crowd said as they walked home. Who is this Jesus? What will you say as you go home? If you're restless, come to the one who'll give you rest for your soul. If you're thirsty, come to the one who can quench your thirst. If you're hungry, come to the one who can satisfy your deepest inner